Hello, my name is Matthew Kempen. I'm the Marketing Manager for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, and welcome to the latest in our In Conversation podcast series. Today we're joined by Professor David Cottrell. David was appointed Foundation Chair in Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Leeds in 1994. He is a co-author of the NICE Guidelines on the Management of Depression in Children and Young People, and has also recently conducted the biggest randomised controlled trial for self-harm, better known as SHIFT. David, welcome. Firstly, we'd like to thank you on behalf of ACAM for participating in the JCPP special issue on suicide and self-harm as one of our expert commentators. We think that this special issue really highlights the diverse research activities that are going on worldwide that aim to better understand suicidal and self-harming behaviours in adolescents. David, as one of our expert commentators, what, in your opinion, do you think is needed to bring all of this information together?
The obvious answer is to say that it's events like this and things like your special edition, because I think there's a lot of research going on all over the world in different places and conducted by different people. But so much is going on that there's a real need for people to bring things together, to summarise, to review, to constructively criticise, and to try and make a sense of what's becoming an increasingly divergent and sometimes contradictory body of evidence. So the importance of kind of reviewing, summarising, critiquing and making more easily available to clinicians is, you know, shouldn't be underestimated. But even when we do that, there are still a lot of unknowns out there. A lot of this is highlighted by some of the presentations at the conference and the articles in the special issue. One of the nice things about the special issue and the practitioner review that starts it is a kind of what I think of as a pathway approach, which looks at things which might predict self-harm, things that we can do to prevent self-harm, and then things that we might be able to do once self-harm has taken place in order to stop it happening again. And the articles in the special issue kind of follow that path. And there's research presented about all the different elements. And I think that points us to where some of the gaps are on what the future needs, which is we need to get better at attending to those predictors because they give us insights into why people might self-harm in the first place. And if we understand better about why it's happening and we're better at recognising people who might be at risk, we can then develop more effective interventions to target those people and the reasons why those people are thinking of self-harm in order to stop self-harm happening. I think at the moment the research rather tends to take large groups of people, and in some cases not so large groups, which is another problem, but large groups of young people who have self-harmed and assume they're all the same and therefore one intervention will be useful for them. And I think what we're really dealing with is lots of different, you know, every young person is different, every person's self-harm is different, but the idea that you can take dozens or hundreds of people and assume they're all going to respond to the same sort of intervention seems to me to be on face value unlikely. And so I think we need to use the research we've got to start targeting better and working out what works for which child, rather than thinking that we're going to find a magic bullet that will work for all children.
The UK government has prioritised investment in innovative school-based prevention programmes for self-harm and suicide. What do you consider are the current barriers to developing, managing, and evaluating such school-based programmes, and what is needed to improve their chances of success?
Good questions. We already... Prevention is one of the areas where the evidence is a little stronger. And we already know from a number of programmes in the United States that prevention does seem to be effective. However, we know from research in other areas that sometimes what works in one country won't necessarily work in another. You know, we all have very different healthcare systems, education systems, different cultures, different ways of behaving and being. And so what might work in the United States won't necessarily work in the UK. So whilst research is expensive, and some people might argue that we should just believe what's already there. I think there is an argument that says that this research needs to be repeated. It needs to be repeated in different places, and it probably needs to be repeated by people who didn't invent the intervention. Because again, sadly, we do sometimes find that the people who've developed the wonderful idea, they're very enthusiastic, they deliver it to a very high standard, and whilst they get good results, other people can't do it as well and don't get such good results. So I think one thing we need to do is be crystal clear that it will work here and that we can replicate what other people have found. But ultimately, when you talk about the barriers to developing this, and implementing it, it's about the will to do it and about the funding. These programs require resources, often people who go out there and identify the young people who are at risk and deliver interventions to try and ameliorate the situation. And you can't do that within existing resources. We're talking about adding in extra to what's already there. Yes, a lot of schools have got counselling services and mental health services, and CAMHS in schools has developed a lot over the last few years. But if we're talking about wider scale prevention programmes for young people who haven't yet come into services, we're going to need extra resources, not just using what we've got smarter. One obvious example is the way services are organised. Most good research compares an intervention you're interested in with some kind of control or comparison condition, and often that's treatment as usual. Well, the kinds of services that are provided to everybody in the UK under the NHS are very different from what's provided in the United States, with a different model of healthcare delivery and payment for healthcare. So sometimes it's the case that what's on offer to people who don't get the intervention of interest is really not very much, and so you might expect to see a difference when you then compare that in the UK with basic services which are quite good. Then perhaps it's not surprising you don't get such a big difference.
We mentioned at the top of the podcast that you were involved in producing the NICE guidelines on the management of depression in children and young people. Having gained this insight into how prominent guidelines are put together, could you explain what it takes to impact policy and what recent findings you have felt might even impact on the field of self-harm and suicide prevention?
First of all, the NICE guidelines. I think what I learned from that process is that probably more than anything else, you need a long-term commitment, both in terms of policy and in terms of funding. One of the things we recommended in the NICE guidelines was that psychological treatments should be the treatment of choice for young people with mild to moderate depression, and that in particular group or individual cognitive behaviour therapy would probably be indicated as the first line treatment in most of those mild to moderate cases. Now, we all know that there are huge waiting lists in CAMHS, and there were back then, before officially austerity started. But even then, the investment needed to skill up the workforce, to ensure that there were enough people out there with the skills to deliver group or individual CBT, was really quite a big ask. And it did start to happen. But again, you can't flick a switch and suddenly have lots of people in CAMHS services able to deliver interventions. It takes time to identify people, to recruit them, to train them, to supervise them, to ensure that what they're delivering is of a good standard, and to monitor the whole system to make sure you are getting the effects that you were hoping for. And all of that takes time, and it's not just money, it's the kind of commitment and the policy which gets followed through year after year after year. And we started to see that in the years after the NICE guideline development, and things have improved, but sadly, the evidence we have now around the difficulties that CAMHS services are having with more referrals and fewer resources is that it's still very hard for young people to get seen quickly, and for them to get the evidence-based services which they know they need. So, sort of 10, 12 years on from the NICE guideline, I don't think although we're doing better than we were, we're still not doing as well as we would have liked to. And I think all of those things will apply to prevention and treatment of self-harm. It seems to me most unlikely, and none of the evidence at the moment suggests that it would be the case, that some kind of medication solution is going to be effective. It's quite easy to learn how to prescribe a new medicine. It's likely that it's going to be skilled people doing things in the community, with schools, with families, with young people, that's going to make a difference. And that requires the time and the investment and the skills of people that you know, we found were needed for the NICE guidelines.
Many of our listeners will be familiar with your large, multi-centred, randomised controlled trial investigating systemic family therapy following teenage self-harm, better known as SHIFT. David, could you tell us a little bit about the conception of SHIFT?
Well, it's not, sadly, it's not been the most world-changing piece of research that we'd hoped at one point it might be. In terms of the conception, this was a commissioned call. We talked just now about the NICE guidelines for depression. There are also NICE guidelines for self-harm. And then there was a review of the NICE guidelines for self-harm. And as well as bringing forward the best evidence-based guidance for how clinicians might behave in the face of self-harm, NICE guidelines do very detailed reviews of the evidence and highlight gaps in the evidence and make recommendations for further research. And one of the recommendations from the NICE guideline was that there needed to be more research in this field, because at the time there was very little evidence that anything made a difference. And that led to the UK National Institute for Health Research commissioning research into self-harm, and specifically saying that because there were so many indicators that families were important, that they'd like research looking at a family-based intervention in self-harm. So in Leeds, and with colleagues in London at the Institute of Psychiatry and in Manchester, we had a group that were already engaged in self-harm research and trying to understand self-harm. We were also involved in family therapy, teaching and training and research. And so we thought we were in a good position to do this. We bid for the grant that was available, and we were fortunate enough to be shortlisted and then awarded the grant. It was a very big trial. Our sample size calculations suggested we'd need 300 or 400 people in each arm of the trial. So we recruited across large swathes of the country, and in the end had 832 young people who'd self-harmed, allocated to either a structured, well-supervised family therapy delivered by properly trained family therapists, or treatment as usual. At the end of 8 months, our primary outcome, which was the time to the next self-harm event, was roughly equal in both groups. And we've just finished a follow-up to a minimum of 3 years. Some people have been followed up for 5 or 6 years, and that suggests that the two groups are still roughly equal in time to first self-harm for a longer period. There were other interesting findings, though. Although we had quite a bit of dropout for the secondary outcome data, it did suggest that in terms of general mental health and scores on things like the strengths and difficulties questionnaires, there were significant positive improvements in the family therapy group. It just didn't seem to affect whether they self-harmed or not. We also found that because we had such a large sample, we could look at subgroups and see if there were certain subgroups that might respond differently. And there were some interesting findings related to young people and their families' ability to talk about feelings with each other. And we found that where young people rated themselves as finding it very hard to talk about feelings, actually family therapy might not be the best treatment for them. They might do worse than other treatments. On the other hand, where families together said, we're not very good at talking about feelings, then family therapy did seem to be better at reducing self-harm. So this relates back to what I was saying earlier about how a one-size-all-fits-all solution might not be the best one. And what we started to find from our study was that maybe there are some groups of young people that you can kind of pick out and say, this group will do better with family therapy and will self-harm less. But actually, maybe some others will do worse, and that, you know, we still don't know what to do for them. So I think that's how our study and other large studies will start to shape what's going forward.
Yeah, there's some really interesting findings from that. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the other research that you're kind of working on?
So at the moment, we're involved in another self-harm related project with Dennis Ugrin this time as one of our collaborators. Dennis is one of the co-editors of the special edition that we're talking about. We're doing what's called an individual patient data meta-analysis of all the good quality randomised controlled trials of interventions in self-harm. Now, many people, including Dennis, have done some excellent meta-analyses and systematic reviews in this field, which is where you kind of pull together all the good studies and you pull the results to see whether with a large number of participants you can glean findings which weren't available from the individual smaller studies. What we're doing is rather different. We're doing something called an individual patient data meta-analysis, which some people may not have come across. The key difference is that in a standard systematic review and meta-analysis, you take the published data, you pool it, and you reanalyze it. But you're working with the data that's out there in the public domain. With an individual patient data meta-analysis, we identify eligible studies that are of good quality, i.e. they're trying to intervene in self-harm in teenagers. And then we approach the authors of those studies and ask if they'd be willing to share their data. And we get their original data. One of the advantages of that is we can include more people in our analysis, because there are some studies out there which have a sample of young people from 15 to 25. But when you just look at the papers that have been published, they lump all that data together, so we don't know which are the teenagers and which aren't. If we've got the original data, we can pull out just the under 18s and add them to our new large data set and include them and ignore the others. We can also start to look again at subgroups, and I know this is becoming a recurring theme, but it's what I'm most interested in at the moment. And with a very large group with all the original data, we can start to look to see if there are subgroups who have different outcomes according to the background characteristics that they have as individuals or the kinds of treatment that they get. So we're in the middle of that at the moment. We're identifying relevant studies, and we're in the interesting process of asking researchers all over the world if they'd be willing to send us their life's work. And that's difficult in many ways, not least some of the data security and governance issues which it raises about how can we reassure those people that their data will be safe and that confidentiality will be assured. But that we hope we'll be talking about in maybe 18 months to 2 years' time.
Well, very much look forward to that. Finally, David, earlier this year, ACAM created the David Cottrell Education of CAM Professionals Award. This is for outstanding contribution to the education and or training of CAM's professionals. How do you feel about having this award named after you, and what do you hope it will achieve?
Enormously proud, I think, is the first thing to say. I've been a member of ACAM and the Association of, you know, Child Psychology and Psychiatry before it for more than 30 years. I'm a past chair of the association, and I've always been a huge fan of ACAM, not least because it's one of the few academic organisations that related to young people, or I think in any field, which is so genuinely multidisciplinary. And children's services are multidisciplinary, and so I think it's essential that academic organisations related to them are multidisciplinary. So I'm a big fan of ACAM. To have an ACAM, I'm also, as people who know me will know, passionate about teaching and its importance, as well as research. So to have an award like this named after me was just very, I was very touched and very proud. And I think teaching and research are hopelessly intertwined as part of the academic endeavour. We've already talked about the importance of you know, implementing research findings and making sure that they happen in practice, and the need to train professionals up in new skills when they're shown to be evidence-based. All of that involves teaching skills. There's no point in doing research if you don't also disseminate the findings, and that involves teaching skills. So you can't have the two sides of the same coin. I'm delighted that ACAM have chosen to recognise it, because it means ACAM have also recognised that teaching is an important part of the academic process and as important as research. And I'm doubly delighted that they've named it after me. I'm coming to the end of my career, and it's a very nice gesture from a society that I hold very dear.
Well, it's a well-deserved honour, David. Thank you very much for your time. You're able to watch David's discussion on self-harm on the ACAM website. The URL for that is www.acamh.org.